Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Yes, welcome to Lost in the Static, everybody. I'm Scott. With me, as always, is Josh.
Should I talk now?
You should talk. In fact, you should talk about a great place to get sexy stuffs.
AdamandEve.com.
Yes.
Go there. Use the promo code STATIC and get 50% off of a single item. It's 50%. That's half off, man, of a single item. That's just amazing. And then they won't even charge you shipping in the U.S. Even more amazing. They'll throw in three fucking DVDs. Literally, three fucking DVDs. They'll even throw in a mystery gift. Why would you not go to AdamandEve.com and use the promo code STATIC? Plus, I actually feel like a whore after that.
A little bit, but the nice thing is you also get a nice warm and fuzzy feeling knowing that you're helping Josh and I keep the lights on.
Yes, we get a percentage, so
especially this time
spend
of year,
more.
Especially this time of year when everybody's he's looking for Christmas gifts and stuff. And
sex toys make very good Christmas gifts for couples. Just make sure you label them correctly so Junior doesn't get the vibrator.
Yeah, it'd be really, really, really embarrassing to give a rabbit to your mother-in-law. But and
it'd anyway. Be even more embarrassing if she said, "I've always wanted one of these."
I'm gonna try it out now and show everybody. Oh God,
those are the kind of relatives that when you have a pissing contest, your aunt wins.
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing that they can do is, if they are going to be shopping for Christmas gifts right about now, they can go to Amazon.com. Actually, no, don't. Clear your cookies, shut off your ad blocker, go to 1201beyond.com.
You do this every time you do the ad.
I really do, because I expect there to be some sort of code or something. But nonetheless, go to 1201beyond.com, go through our ads, buy your family's Christmas gifts from Amazon, have Amazon ship them to your family so you don't have to deal with that. And you get another nice little warm feeling knowing that Josh and I get a little cut of everything that you buy there.
I'm fighting with a black cat on the ground. He's pawing at me.
Yes.
So, I don't know the first thing about what we're going to talk about tonight. I mean, I know what the topic is, but I don't know the first thing about it. So, you go.
That is absolutely no problem. You mentioned a while back that we hadn't really talked about anything tech-oriented. And so I thought, rather than talking about old technology, which we have, and we've gotten all nostalgic about jazz drives and that kind of stuff, I thought that we would go a little bit further back into the 30s, 40s, and 50s and take a look at really the father of modern computer science and the man who, without this man's philosophy and without this man's mathematical thinking and work both with the government and in other areas, we really wouldn't have computers as we know them. And this man is a man by the name of Alan Turing.
Okay.
Now, Alan, the other reason I wanted to talk about him was because a fan wrote me, and he said, "Hey, Scott, you're bisexual, and yet we don't really hear you talk about gay rights much on the show, and you don't really play up your gayness." Well, this is one of my heroes, and Alan Turing also happened to be gay in decades when...
In a time when that was socially unacceptable.
Yeah, in a time when... A lot of people feel that he died in 1954 of cyanide poisoning.
Oh, even better, a murder.
No, suicide.
Self-murder?
But, yeah.
Suicide is self-murder, so I'm True. Still technically not wrong.
True, but he died of cyanide poisoning in 1954, mainly because of, we'll call them lawful complications around his homosexuality.
Yeah, homosexuality was kind of a persecuted...
Yeah, it was basically a death sentence at the time. Maybe not in the way of actually killing you, but...
Killing your spirit, more or less.
You kill your spirit, you go to jail for a very long time, and you live with pretty much the same social stigma that pedophiles live with now. But Alan Turing... is best known for the Turing test. Now, I mentioned this to you last week, and you were like...
Yeah, I'm like, elaborate.
What the hell is a Turing test? Well, imagine that we came up with you sitting at a computer and you have two chat windows open. One is the actual me and one is a computer simulation of me. In order,
I hate both of them.
But we're on the right track. We're right there. But in order for whatever simulation of me is running to pass the Turing test, you cannot be able to tell the difference between chatting with me or chatting with this simulation of me, or chatting with a real human versus chatting with a bot.
Well, does the bot misspell common words like you do?
If it's, you know what, if it's...
Because whenever we've chatted, I can tell it's you. It's like, yeah, only he misspells those words.
Or only he reverses those letters the way he does that. Yes, if it's a well-written simulation and they really are going for me, they're going to throw in those misspellings and those mistakes as part of being human. And there have been a lot of little programs like this that have tried the Turing test. One of the earliest being, you may have even heard of it, called ELIZA.
I don't know. It's ringing a slight bell.
ELIZA was a computer psychotherapist that you could load up on your Apples or IBMs or whatever back in the day.
All right. Now, for the Turing test, does it have to be a simulation of another person, or, and now it's a shit movie, but, or something like that movie Simone from the early 2000s. Remember that, where they had a computer generated movie star that was she only existed in the computer, or would something like Simone be part of that?
Simone might, could very,
because
that's, well,
not
be
based on, you know, a person. It was a created conglomerate of everything that they thought of movie star should be.
Right. And yeah, that was basically something passing the Turing test. If people go, we talked about Looker a while back.
Yep.
If you're watching a TV commercial and you believe that that's an actress doing her thing and not a simulation,
then would you even throw CGI in there? Like, say they didn't want to endanger a squirrel in a tire commercial that's about to get hit by a car. They didn't want to really have a car coming at a real squirrel. So they CGI a squirrel that's so realistic, you can't tell.
That's a visual Turing test. Now, what else comes into that Turing test is what they call the motor Turing test. And that is, does it move like a squirrel? Does it move believably? And usually when it comes to CGI, that's where it breaks down. Is you look and you go, okay, that looks a lot like a squirrel, but oh, it's not twitchy enough. It's very fluid in the way that it looks around. It's not moving quite like a squirrel. That's a visual Turing test. The original Turing test, the actual Turing test, was specifically with language and conversation.
All right, then let me ask you this one, and I'm not changing the subject.
Okay. But
the Canadian, and when I say technological philosopher, I don't mean a philosopher on technology. I mean a philosopher on technology, okay? Marshall McLuhan. He's where one of the people we get a ton of what we now have as common phrases, such as the medium is the message. He's the one that coined the term the global village, things like that. He's the basis for a lot of Videodrome, a movie that you and I both think is visionary. Well, he died I think he died in the 1980s. Early 80s, I think. And
yeah. In fact, the last day of 1980.
Okay. Well, there was somebody on the Wired forums and Wired magazine's early days that was claiming to be Marshall McLuhan. And it was, it had all the same inflections. And it was talking about new technology. So it wasn't somebody cutting and pasting old McLuhan books or anything like that.
Okay.
They were talking about new current things using his inflections, the way he punctuated, the way he wrote, you know, maybe certain misspellings, whatever, for almost two full years, to such a degree that even McLuhan's friends and family couldn't tell that that was not McLuhan some 15 years after his death writing to Wired magazine. Yeah. Now, obviously, that was a person doing it.
Right.
So that's why it's not necessarily, but is that kind of what you're talking about, where this person impersonated Marshall McLuhan to the point where even McLuhan's friends said, I can't decisively say Marshall didn't write this.
If you can imagine a computer doing that, if you can imagine those letters being computer generated. Now, there's a whole lot of other various things you would have to teach the computer about, new technology. You'd have to teach this would have to become an AI of some sorts. But that's also what Turing talked about, was writing this computer program to do things so well that you couldn't tell the difference. And again, if we're talking about letter correspondence, if we're talking about casual conversation, he always, one of the things that he talked about, even back in the 40s and 50s when he was working for the U.S. government, he was working on voice synthesis. And his ultimate goal was to have, say, you sitting in that chair and then a big curtain. And then on the other side of the curtain, you have one person sitting in another chair talking to you, and then a voice box.
So it's not like War Games. Would you like to play a game?
Right. That would fail the Turing test because it's obviously a computer talking to you.
Okay. The first Terminator movie. After the Terminator kills the beat cop and then impersonates his voice to call in the radio to stop other cops from showing up, it's a computer. It's pretending to be somebody else.
Yeah, it's a computer that would pass the Turing test. I mean, even if we came upon the T-1000 and he had morphed into me, how do you tell the difference between the T-1000 and me? That's a computer that passes the Turing test.
Okay.
On both a visual and auditory and philosophical and conversational level.
To take this into a movie kind of scenario, Skynet. Skynet from the Terminator franchise.
Okay.
A self-aware computer that made its own decisions and got paranoid about itself. Would Skynet?
I don't think so, because people always knew that it was a computer that they were talking to. Even though it got self-aware and became paranoid and everything like that, which is, on a philosophical level, would pass the Turing test because A, self-awareness, B, paranoia.
Okay, how about going back to War Games? How about Joshua, the computer program Joshua?
No.
It thought Professor Falcon was still alive, and it refused to believe that Professor Falcon was not the person inputting the code to it.
Yeah, but no, that was still an obvious program with a mathematical algorithm expressed through both thermonuclear war and tic-tac-toe.
If I thought it'd make a difference, I'd piss on a spark plug.
Exactly. No, that wouldn't pass the Turing test because it's still a computer. Even if we put the perfect voice into the computer of War Games, we would still know it's a computer because of how it works out problems.
All right. Now, how about this? Now, I know you're not a big comic fan, but in the Aliens comics, this pre-Alien 3 and Resurrection coming out, okay? The first story that came out with Newton Hicks that was an official sequel to Aliens. Plot twist here, people. They go to the Aliens, what they think is the Aliens' homeworld, with a contingent of Marines, specifically chosen Marines. Well, the Marines keep getting passed up by facehuggers. Like, hey, something ain't right here. Turns out that the Marines are androids. They're androids that are so advanced that they didn't even know that they were androids.
Okay, now you're getting into Blade Runner territory.
I was just about to say, or Rachel from Blade Runner.
Right.
She did not know she was a replicant.
Mm-hmm.
And technically, if you go with Ridley Scott's stupidity, Deckard being a replicant, which is just stupid. Ridley Scott has now come out and officially said Deckard's a replicant. And it's like, no. Yet the writers, David and Martha Peoples, I think is her name, have said, no, he was never a fucking replicant. To me, I choose to believe Deckard was not a replicant because the story doesn't make sense if he is.
Right. But yeah, your replicants in Blade Runner, they to an extent pass the Turing test until you send them into an acid field and they keep working.
All right. Then how about biological computers? A clone. a clone of somebody would have the same inflections, the same thought patterns, etc., especially if it was raised the same, but it would technically be a copy of the original.
See,
or am I throwing in too many variables?
You're throwing in too many variables, because if you start talking about, number one, a clone is not a biological computer. It's a cloned biological entity.
If you listen to certain scienticians, that's a Futurama word for me. If you listen to certain scienticians, that the whole body is just a biological computer.
Yeah, and
if you, that's a, you know, if you really get into scientician thought.
In some ways, it is. In I
just picture Professor Farnsworth saying that.
See, when I think of a biological computer, I think of the new biological chips, where you actually have a little colony of usually bacteria or some sort of cellular organism acting as the switch on, switch off computer.
And see, I've seen way too many horror movies and Armageddon flicks to know that that's not going to end well.
That's a brilliant idea. I'm all for it, frankly. But
nothing can go wrong, Scott.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But no, you're throwing in too many variables, and then you get into chaos theory, which, by the way, Turing worked with as well. Twins are basically clones. They really are. But, for instance, I have two little step-nieces that are identical twins. And for the first 5 years of me knowing them, I couldn't tell them apart. Now, they were raised in the same household, same age, same experiences through, but there were little tiny differences, and now they are two very unique individuals. And that's the way any clone is going to turn out. Even if you raise them in the same house at the same time with the same blah and the same blah, and they share the room and all
something's
that,
different.
They're, thank you, chaos theory. There are going to be small differences that just explode out.
Okay, how about going back to Videodrome, Brian Oblivion?
Okay.
What about Brian Oblivion? Do you remember which character he was?
He
was the one that had been dead for decades, but they had that entire library of all the different videotapes him, and they had basically been keeping him alive, going on TV shows, obviously always appearing on a monitor or whatnot, and that technically it wasn't a computer. It was, you know, a videotape library that was compositing the different inflections and things that they needed. It was done through editing on their part, but the character of Brian Oblivion.
Did another human do the editing?
They never really went into that. They never really went into if that was a human or the Videodrome signal itself that did it.
Let's take this out of Videodrome for a moment, and let's pretend that if we gave a computer a central server, and we somehow reached the singularity, and upon his death, we took Brian Oblivion's consciousness and everything that he knew about himself and all of that and uploaded it to the computer and said, okay, here's your video library. You can now composite what you want him to say using this library. If that computer could successfully make people believe that it was Brian Oblivion in machine form, it would pass the Turing test. As it was, because they didn't really go into it, I kind of think there was a human brain behind it.
Okay. I'm just saying, you know, when we were discussing this when you were smoking, that's where I kind of went to was the Brian Oblivion character in Videodrome. I just kind of went there that, you know, the guy hadn't existed for quite some time, but he was still existing on television.
Right.
In new ways.
Kind of new ways. They were new ways that were edited together from old appearances, basically. But yeah, at least visually, in order to pass the Turing test, he would still have to appear as if he were alive. So always appearing on a monitor, no, you don't pass the Turing test.
But how would you pass the Turing test if, like, to go back to your two windows open chatting thing, you're not appearing to be alive. It's just, you know, I'm not seeing you or hearing your voice.
Again, that's a conversational Turing test. There are visual Turing tests, there are philosophical Turing tests, and then there is a conversational Turing test.
All right. Well, then to change the subject slightly, but not that much, let's talk about technological visionaries like Turing, like Marshall McLuhan, the sure. people who were able to see the future. I mean, we talked about it a little bit in the Looker Videodrome episode, you know, mm-hmm. that there were these people that were able to see where things were going, even if it was way down the line.
Sure.
They were able to see where things were going, and they either tried to warn us about it or just tried to make us aware of it, and either way, we didn't listen.
Or in the case of Roddenberry, tried to see this future of where we were going and tried to push us in that direction.
But his was a ridiculous future that was never going to happen. We're never going to put aside all the ridiculous squabble and racial bullshit. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we're never going to do any of that.
I know, but that was the future that he saw, and he tried to push us that way at least. So,
right. So who else would you put up there? Last week, we talked a little bit about Steve Jobs. I do see Steve Jobs as a genius, okay? You know, you look at what he did at Atari and whatnot prior sure. to going to Apple and whatnot, him and sure. Wozniak and all that. But as you pointed out, he didn't develop most of the technology that he now gets credit for. He supervised other people developing it.
Jobs was a genius when it comes to running a company. He was a genius he was a very charismatic genius. Meaning that he knew how to manipulate people. They always, they called it the Jobs reality field. And somehow the presence of Steve Jobs bends reality to make rather minor upgrades look like major innovations.
Well, all right, on the same token then, and I'm not comparing these two people, but kind of the same effect, Steve Jobs to Charles Manson. Charles Manson, that we know, never actually killed anybody. He just supervised other people killing people.
Right.
So in that regard, would you say Steve Jobs and Charles Manson were on the same level?
I'm not the only one to make that comparison.
I just thought of it. I haven't heard that one.
I know. Before. I have.
Okay.
And they have been compared, and they were very similar. It's just that Jobs was a genius at saying no. He knew what to say no to. He knew he had an idea of what he wanted design-wise, and he was a genius in the fact that he handed it over to his designers and went, okay, I want something like this, make it work. And if they came back with something that didn't quite make it work, he said, no, go do it again. And like I said, his reality distortion field of being such a charismatic man in one sense and such a tyrannical asshole in another, he was a PR genius. He really was. So that's where his genius lies. Manson was very similar.
Yeah.
I mean, he convinced teenage girls to go kill.
And Tex Watson.
And Tex Watson and some girls that weren't quite teenagers anymore, but.
But okay, then who would you call like the technological visionaries? Not necessarily of today, but that you think really shaped what today is, even if they did it in the 30s, 40s, or 50s, but they shaped what today is. Like, I was actually a little shocked when I did a Sanity article and I brought up Marshall McLuhan, and I got a lot of people going, I don't know who that is. And I kind of went, really? How do so many people not know who Marshall McLuhan is? Because he influenced so much of the way we look at technology. I mean, he basically was, in the 60s, predicted kind of like what TV would become today, like the way Paddy Chayefsky in the 70s predicted Fox News and CNN and MSNBC would become. You know, how do so many people not know who Marshall McLuhan is?
Because a lot of those people,
especially,
they start with a very tight inner circle. And then that inner circle interacts with the rest of society, because you'll notice that a lot of people, Nikola Tesla,
okay,
did not interact with the world very well.
But I mean, McLuhan wrote a ton of books, and look at the phrases like the global village and the mm-hmm. medium is mm-hmm. the message. Those are phrases that people say, but they don't know where they originate.
Yeah, and they get lost.
That bothers me.
Now you asked,
not making a pun, they get lost in the static.
You asked me, who I think the visionaries of today are.
Yeah.
Number one, for me, you know, Alan Turing, of course, he is the father of modern computer science. Every innovation of how a computer thinks and looking at the philosophy of computing. And I'm not just raw code, not just his amazing innovations in cryptography and cryptology, but his innovations in looking at a machine and going, okay, if this machine had a brain, number one, let's look at the biology of that brain, such as chips and stuff like that. And he kind of had an idea for integrated chips long before they came around.
Would you put McLuhan on that list? Even though I know you're generally unfamiliar with him, but
I might. I would put McLuhan on. McLuhan didn't really do much technologically. McLuhan was a philosophical forward thinker. He was a societal forward thinker. He didn't.
But he influenced how the technology shaped society.
Well, he influenced the shape of technology and the way that technology interacts with society.
And the way society interacts with technology.
By influencing society.
All right, now to...
Versus Turing on the other side, or Nikola Tesla, or the two guys, Kilby and Noyce, who came up with the integrated chip. They influenced society and the way that society interacts with technology by directly influencing technology.
All right, how about... I know it's only film, but film is such a large, you know, movies are such a large part of our society. I hate to keep beating this horse to death, but Orson Welles. You go back all the way to 1941 and look at Citizen Kane, and you look at how many techniques he and his cinematographer invented. You know, the forced perspective and the ultra low angle and all these different camera techniques that are just at today. Anybody does these, but they don't know where they come from. Yeah. They are things that someone like Welles helped invent, but nobody thinks of him like that. Right. Nobody thinks of Orson Welles as being a genius filmmaker in the way of being a filmmaker that came up with techniques nobody thought could have been done in 1941.
And prior to that, coming up with ideas in radio drama.
Yeah, the way he did War of the Worlds had never been done before. Mm-hmm. He could have done a straight adaptation like, you know, Sleepy Hollow or something.
Sure.
No, he said, I'm going to fuck with people's minds.
Okay. So are you still asking me who I think?
I'm saying, like, would Orson Welles be? Because technology, I mean, technically film, but the technology and film influence society as well.
Sure, but again,
or the technology of film, I mean.
But again, this is using filmmaking techniques in order to bring about an emotional response. You know, if I'm shooting a low camera angle up at someone, something in my brain as an audience member goes, "Oh my God, they're ominous and scary because I'm looking up at them. I'm regressing back to my childhood." When maybe a grown-up I didn't know and a stranger was somebody that scared me.
Okay.
And you're going right back there. If I'm looking down on somebody, I know that they're immediately reduced somehow. They're not a threat. You know, in fact, I am probably looking through the eyes of something being threatening. And again, that's working with the human brain to... use an art form to come up with, to elicit these emotional responses. The visionaries that I wanted to talk about today are the ones that, rather than using an existing technology to elicit an emotional response, I'm talking about ones that immediately worked at the chip level, worked at the code level of technology to come up with something that truly broke through.
Would you say even his name fell out of my head, but the inventor of Atari,
Bushnell?
Bushnell, thank you. I'm just picturing this kindly old man with a white beard and Showbiz Pizza.
Yes.
Bushnell.
Nolan Bushnell.
Because, I mean, he was not, you know, like we pointed out, Jobs didn't necessarily do all the things. He supervised them. Bushnell was in there with a soldering gun putting chips on boards.
Yeah, he started out with an oscilloscope and came up with a tennis game.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, table tennis, I think.
Yes, he is a direct, you know, he's definitely a visionary when it comes to gaming and when it comes to interacting with computers as entertainment.
Marketing,
yeah,
too.
Huge, huge. Yeah, marketing as well.
Because everyone thinks of Atari as a failure company only after Warner Brothers bought it.
Only after Warner Brothers bought it.
Not when Nolan Bushnell owned it.
Right. And looking at something, one of Bushnell's other deals, Showbiz Pizza or Chuck E. Cheese.
Nope, Showbiz Pizza and Chuck E. were competitors. So
right, and I'm trying to figure which one.
Showbiz was his.
Showbiz was his. Showbiz started, and it was Bushnell that came up with lots and lots of techniques for the animatronics. And again, talking about working with technology as direct entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, Disney. Disney looked at Showbiz for some of their newer animatronics. Yes, the WED was going crazy with their Imagineering.
Imagineering? Is that a word?
Yes, it is, actually. Okay. That's a copyright Disney word. They were going crazy with their Imagineering and coming up with their animatronics, but believe it or not, they were influenced by Showbiz Pizza and its animatronics. And Showbiz Pizza was also influenced by WED at the time. But so, yeah, he was a visionary. Other visionaries working on the code level, you've got Sergey Brin and his partner, whose name I can't remember. Luckily, it's in front of me. Larry Page. They invented the Google algorithm.
The search engine as we know it?
Right. And they're the ones that invented the search engine and then built the company into the Googleplex that it is today. Luckily, they've surrounded themselves with lots and lots of other visionaries. You know, go back to the very basic part of the web. You've got Tim Berners-Lee, who came up with HTML. I mean, that is working with coding and saying, okay, we're going to have all of this information out there on the web, and currently we're accessing it through FTP and Gopher and Archie and Betty and Veronica and all of the, you know, Pine and Oak and Cherry and all of those text-based information gathering things. And he goes, but that's not how people work. You can't just learn by reading words. You have to throw a little bit of visual stimulus into it. And that's why he came up with a World Wide Web.
Which, you know, for those that don't know, yes, the internet kind of existed all the way back into the late 70s. But not the way people picture the internet today.
Right.
It was all text-based. The only way you got a picture, you didn't get a picture. Do you remember those old where you'd have to print out numbers?
Oh, that would,
you know, each the numbers would eventually form.
ASCII art is what it's called.
Yes, I couldn't remember what it was called. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't, the internet was basically text only. That's all it was text.
When I started, it was completely text only, and that was at Ball State University. And you could do any ASCII character, which it's ASCII for those that don't know. And you would draw pictures using those. MUDs were all text-based. Even though you were a little character, usually an asterisk, running around a maze, they were all ASCII characters and all text-based. And they were fun. The inventor of email, Ray Tomlinson. Can you imagine today without email?
No.
Yeah, it would suck. Sure.
Except you and I both remember, unlike some of our younger contemporary counterparts, you and I actually do remember a time prior to that when phone calls and, I hate this term, but snail mail, I hate people that say it like that, was how you communicated.
Yeah. And you know, we wouldn't be able to do this without email, and there's a lot of information exchange on the web that is using the technology behind email and the code behind email, even part of HTML. Just the very ability to send a message from one machine to another. Brilliant. Now, there's another one that I'm glad I have this list in front of me because I couldn't remember all of these names, even though I was like, oh yeah, the guy that did this and the guy that did this. You know damn well what Douglas Engelbart did. Okay. Don't read the paragraph. It's in your right hand every day.
My cock?
No. Douglas Engelbart did not design your penis.
Oh, okay.
Well, the one that I have now doesn't have any wheels in it. But when they first started out, they were...
A moose.
Yeah. They were a big, big brown box with a single kind of a round, ugly button on it. And it had two wheels, one vertical, one horizontal. And you have people basing everything on the mouse now. I mean, Apple, when we switched from, you know, to a GUI, a graphical user interface, from a text-based user interface, the mouse became a real necessity. Now, the first three computers I owned didn't have mice. The first two didn't even have the ability to plug a mouse into it.
Well, you even go back to a TV series like Max Headroom. You'll notice for all the computer stuff that they do and how many searches and hacks and stuff, they don't use a mouse at all. There's no mouse hooked up. That was a conscious decision for them to say no external input devices. It's all done on a keyboard.
Yeah, it drives me nuts.
But that was a specific design choice that they went for, which gives it a very unique feel too, mm-hmm. doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. And it's carried over. In fact, even you know, in shows like Warehouse 13, you'll notice that for some reason the old dude, whenever he uses a computer, never touches a mouse. He just sits down and apparently uses keyboard shortcuts for everything.
Oh, well, we're gonna have an episode on hackers soon, but that, like, NCIS, the hacking that they do, just
yes.
maybe it's just them banging on random keys. Yes. I've broken through their firewall.
Yes,
and you go, oh, shut up! The writer doesn't even know what a firewall is.
Exactly. But you know, these are the guys that really shaped computers as we know them. And on a basic level, you're familiar with the big beige box.
The big beige box?
Yes.
It sounds like a gay Big Bang Theory
no,
spin-off.
No. Back in the 80s through the 90s, what color were computers?
Oh, you mean those giant metal heat boxes?
Yes, the big beige boxes. You know, I remember when Next Computing came around, when Jobs left Apple and formed Next, they used these huge black magnesium cases. And I thought, how awesome would a black computer be? I could have one.
Is that the same one? There was one where they had the worst tech support in the world. They actually said if, you know, because the box would acquire heat so much and it wasn't ventilated properly, that the chips would actually pop off the circuit board. The actual way that they put it in the booklet, try picking the computer up and dropping it to reseat the chips. Can you imagine that as customer service, man?
Have
you tried picking it up and dropping it?
Yeah. Yeah, that
and
wasn't...
people, I'm not exaggerating. That was real. That was a customer service tip.
That wasn't Next. I forget what...
I remember that being some off-brand, but yeah, it was still some bigger brand.
It was one of the Apple clones. Back when they actually cloned Apples. Again, Steve Jobs leaves, goes form Next, and the dude in charge of Apple goes, IBM is doing really, really well with their clones. Let's just open Apple up. And it was one of their clones that you picked up and dropped. It wasn't the Next computers.
So next time your laptop stops working, maybe just pick it up and drop it. Maybe we'll see how well that works, people.
From a fifth story window.
Onto a row of spikes.
Yes. But, you know, speaking of the big beige box, Hewlett-Packard. They're the ones that came up with the idea for the big beige box.
See, I know them as printers.
Yeah, now that's about all they make that are really good anymore. But they started out as an adding machine company.
Well, and I see on this list someone that, I don't know, Shigeru Miyamoto? Really?
Shigeru Miyamoto. Now,
he was a video game programmer. I don't see him being on the same list as some of these other people.
But when it comes to Nintendo, Nintendo wouldn't be where it is without Miyamoto. And not just...
Even before that, Namco for Pac-Man.
Right. Now that,
and Donkey Kong.
Not just for his games. Shigeru Miyamoto has been... a major influence when it comes to hardware, starting with the Wii. So you've got the Wii with the motion controls. You've got coming up the Wii U. In fact, by the time this airs, the Wii U may have just been released. The Wii Fit, and it was the Wii and this motion control stuff that really kicked. I mean, PlayStation had always been playing with the Move and their video interface with the PS3, and Xbox had been playing with the what is now the Kinect for quite a while. But it was the Wii and the popularity of the Wii and the accessories of the Wii with the Wii Fit and the Wii Motion Plus and the Wii Wii, which was the urinal that you could hook up to the machine, and all kinds of stuff that Shigeru Miyamoto played a huge part in this interface, this little machine that wasn't all that technically impressive, but really changed how video game programmers thought about interfacing with video games. Is it for the better or the worse? I don't know.
All right. Now, I don't know the designers behind this, but I'm sure you've heard that old statistic that the moon landing in 1969, the average 1985 wristwatch contained more computing power and chips than the chips in the moon lander.
Sure.
That's pretty impressive that they were able to do that in 69 with what is really no technology, isn't it?
Well, let's
really when you break it down.
Okay, when you break it down, the moon landing could have been done with UNIVAC. Are you familiar with UNIVAC? Okay, UNIVAC was this huge computer filled a room, and it was UNIVAC that gave us the term computer bug. Because this was, most of UNIVAC was still run on tubes. And
it would get a bug in it?
It broke down, and they couldn't figure out why it broke down. They couldn't figure it out. So they went around, and they checked out the tubes, and they found out that a moth had been attracted to the heat of the computer and the light of the tubes and had shorted out a few of the tubes. And so they said, we've got a bug in the computer.
Makes sense.
There it is.
That makes sense.
UNIVAC was used originally, or at least it was intended to be used, it came along a little bit late, but it was intended to be used during World War II for working out shelling trajectories. So that rather than shooting a whole crapload of shells off of a ship toward a city, they said, well, why don't we come up with this computer that can work out the trajectories?
But see, and that to me is unnecessary because you had people who could do that. That was, they were called spies.
No. They could, the spies came up
spotters.
With
spotters.
The spotters came up with the correct targets, and they gave a general direction, but they weren't very exact. Believe it or not, they really weren't. They would just shoot a crapload of shells into
over
an area.
There. Yes, blow over, up over there.
Over there. It's about this far away at about this elevation with this much power behind it. We should be able to get there. So they would, what they would do is they would take what the spotters gave them and go maybe a degree or so off left and right, a degree or so off up and down, and vary a little bit of power. And then they would shoot six shots. Fa-poo! And all of them would
Fa-poo,
go.
Huh?
Yeah. Exactly. And then all of those six shots would go over, and you might hit your target plus all the area around it.
And maybe a school.
Or maybe you'd be over here. And so they came up with UNIVAC to go, okay, all we need is one shell, one shot solution, and there we go. That's all the computing power you need to get to the moon. That's it. It's a trajectory. It's a shot solution.
All right. Well, then let me ask you something about someone who was extremely technological while admitting himself he didn't really know shit about technology at the time. Someone like William Gibson, who, writing a book like Neuromancer, he was making up what is now
common computing solutions.
Yeah. But he was pulling it out of his ass. He was just, this sounds logical. Let's do this.
Well,
and there are so many people, you can't really deny his influence because there were so many people that would go on to make that technology that read his book and went, that actually does make logical sense.
Sure.
Let's see if I can do it. Soldering.
And that's the difference. He, again, shaped technology by influencing society.
Especially, so a book like Neuromancer.
Especially William Gibson, and there's another author that's always...
Bruce Sterling.
Thank you. As authors, they did what Gene Roddenberry did. They went, guys, look at this crap here. Isn't this cool?
Make it.
Or they just went, like, this is so futuristic and so out there, but it's kind of cool anyway. And then somebody else went, I'm going to make that. It's kind of like the narwhal that sticks his head above the ocean, looks at a horse and goes, I'm going to fuck that. And that's how we get unicorns.
All right, you had me until that last example.
But nonetheless, it's they influenced society to create the technology, but they didn't influence the technology to make it make society better.
But I'm just saying, would you put William Gibson on a list where he really didn't do anything technological himself?
I'd put him on the same.
He only made up technology that later became fact.
I would put him on the same list as, say, Isaac Asimov.
Or Harlan Ellison.
Or Harlan Ellison. Bradbury or any of these authors. But again, they're influencing society. You know, the people that I wanted to talk about today and the people that we have talked about are the people that changed the technology, maybe being influenced by Roddenberry, Bradbury,
Gibson,
Sterling, any of these authors. Maybe they were influenced. The philosophical works of Alan Turing to directly work with technology to come up with this stuff to come up with the mouse, to come up with, you know, why is our keyboard laid out the way it is?
I've never understood. I mean, I do now, but before you learn how to type, it makes no sense why the letters are laid out the way they are.
Oh, it still doesn't.
You'd go, why doesn't it just go A, B, C, D, E, F, G, et cetera, et cetera? But if you did that, because I tried this once. I had an old computer, and I fucked the keyboard up somehow, so all the keys were popped off. So I put them all in alphabetical order. I couldn't type. Yeah. Nothing was coming out as words.
Well, the
because
reason...
it's so ingrained into me where the letters are supposed to be that
yep.
they are now that... putting them alphabetically fucked my brain up. I couldn't type like that.
And what's interesting is back when typewriters were first becoming a thing, there were tons of different keyboard layouts. Now, even computers, I can easily switch to what's
standardized.
Called, it's standardized, what we call the QWERTY layout, Q-W-E-R-T-Y, take a look at your top row. And the reason it worked was because it slowed secretaries down. It slowed typists down. And when you've got mechanical typewriters with the hammers that came up and hit.
Yeah, because if you hit too many keys, they'd get stuck.
Exactly. And they were finding with things like the Dvorak layout that was laid out to make people faster typers, it was too fast. And now it's been so ingrained that QWERTY is standard, it works, even though you can switch your keyboard layout to Dvorak, you can switch your keyboard layout to B, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You can do all of that internally in the computer. It's all available.
Well, and something people don't know about just how much the technology of even just a keyboard has changed. Not so much a keyboard, a typewriter. Let me rephrase that. A typewriter has changed. Early typewriters, and I mean early, even through the 1970s, they were missing letters that you could get by other letters.
L and 1 and
yeah.
F and S.
Yeah, there was no 1. When you needed to type a 1, you typed a lowercase L. And things like that. We would not be able to operate on one of those things. We're so used to this. But then you get someone that, say, grew up in the news system. Because news typewriters always had that shorthand. Because, you know, the fewer keys, the more compact it could be. You could take it on the road easier. So if a key could be duplicated, you did it.
Right.
I can't imagine how hard it was for those people to have to adjust to, as you put out...
to the 104 key keyboard? Sure.
Yeah, to have to adjust to that, to go, no, not a lowercase L. There's actually a 1 button now.
Exactly. Well, imagine, you know, when typewriters first came around, they were rotary layout. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but it's real interesting. You have all of the hammers laid out in this big circle.
Yes.
and you literally dial in the letter you want and then smack the thing on the top, and that's what prints it on the page.
If someone wants to see that, the opening sequence of Kolchak the Night Stalker has a rotary one of those.
There you go.
In the opening sequence of Kolchak the Night Stalker.
And there are many Asian typewriters and typesetters that are still that way. They're laid out on a big square, and the hammer just moves around, and the paper moves below. It's real interesting. And then you find the character you want, boom, because they have so many different characters.
But yeah, so you come up with, I don't know who invented what you call the QWERTY layout. I don't know, you know, if they just saw this old typewriter is just, it's not working the way, you know, I think it could be more effective. Or if he just said, I want to be different. I want to do something different. And then it just kind of caught on.
Well, again, they had to slow secretaries down. Because, like I mentioned, the Dvorak layout, which was an early keyboard layout that people were too fast. And now modern typists and people that type a lot start to learn that Dvorak layout, and you can generally type 25, 35 words per minute faster than your average fast typist, simply because the keyboard layout changes. But this QWERTY layout has been taught for so long that it's a standard.
Yeah, I remember when I first took the typing class in high school, when they were trying to say, you know, well, this is, and I'm like, but it doesn't make sense. Why is A not next to B? Why is C not next to D? This mm-hmm. doesn't make sense. That's just the way I looked at it.
And you want to have fun? There's a cheap kids keyboard, big keys, and it's laid out in alphabetical order. Plug that in, try and type.
I wouldn't be able to.
it gets messy.
It would be word vomit all through.
But yeah, I mean, you know, this was designed to do that. And my God, I'd love to see whoever came up with this to look at a modern keyboard. I mean, there's Control and Alt, which are two new keys. The Windows key is new. And for those of you with Apples, the Option key or whatever the hell it is.
I remember when return used to be enter.
Oh,
remember
yeah.
that? It was the enter key, not the return key.
Well.
Or is yours still enter?
Take a look.
Yours still says enter. The one I use at home says return.
Yep. Actually, return is the old term.
Okay, so enter is the new one? Okay,
enter is the new one.
I got those backwards. Well, we're running out of time, so wrap up on your technological geniuses and shit like that.
PCWorld.com. Just do a search for the 50 most influential people, and yeah, you'd be amazed at how many of these people really are in the background, but who you owe a debt of thanks to.
You wouldn't be able to do what you do. You wouldn't be able to listen to us rant about what we do
without the influence of these people. And every time you interact with a computer, take a moment and do me a favor and think of Robert Turing and think of
Marshall McLuhan.
Well, Marshall McLuhan, but Alan Turing, who was a genius that we lost way too early because of
social stigma,
close-mindedness and social stigma and stupidity. And so, yeah, take a moment to think about that. And I wonder how much genius was squelched.
Well, you'll always be wondering that.
I mean, I know.
You got to look at even going back to Hitler. How many future geniuses did he exterminate? You know,
yeah, but
because a lot of those people were in that same field
sure.
at the time, you know, they were inventing, you know, I hate to say it, but the Nazis had some of the most advanced computer technology of the age. And then they put those people in the gas chamber. So I'm not going all Godwin's law. I'm saying Hitler cut a lot of these people off. Who knows? We might be 10 more years advanced than where we are now if Hitler
sure.
hadn't have killed them after he got what he wanted.
But we are really running out of time. So thank you all very much for joining us this week. I appreciate you putting up with my little history lesson and my little thanks
and
to those that
remarks.
Really need it.
Scienticians. I'm standing by that. I like scienticians.
You do that.
You know
so,
what? Don't be a dick.
Anyway, go to 1201beyond.com. Check out the Amazon
no!
links.
No, you go to adamandeve.com.
Go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code STATIC, And
are we gonna have like dueling plugs for them?
No, no, there's no need for it. But nonetheless, thanks a bunch, guys. We will see you next week. And I'm gonna use my mouse to hit the stop button.